Dalton's Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch. If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask Kiefer Sutherland's father what he thinks.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
This episode, Milton's guest is Gamal Hennessy. Gamal is an attorney for comic book creators, independent publishers, and other creative artists. Gamal is the author of The Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing, which is being crowdfunded now on Kickstarter.
Gamal, thank you for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited to have you on the program here to talk about your upcoming book, The Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing. This sounds like a book that the only flaw that I can see in the outline is that you were not able to write this book 6 or 7 years ago and give it to me when I was going to start producing comics, because I think I really needed it then.
Well, that is a sentiment that I have actually heard from several people they've learned about the business of publishing comics from actually trying it themselves and then failing, or trying it themselves and then realizing there were things that they could have done to make the entire process smoother and easier to work with. And this book hopefully will lay it out, if not for you 6 or 7 years ago, then at least for you in your upcoming project, so you don't have to, you know, worry about it too much.
Yeah, and just glancing over the outline that you provide in your Kickstarter page, the breadth of what you cover is so strong. I feel like 6 years ago me would have gotten a ton of value out of it, but even now, after going through that level of experience, there are still a number of topics that you are covering that I know that I'm going to learn a lot about. And I'm going to try to pepper you with some questions now and get some of that information before I get the book.
Well, but
let me just jump right in. You've got a number of topics that you mentioned are covered in the book. And the very first one is called Developing Intellectual Property That You Own and Control. Right. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when you're starting to make comics, one of the things that you have to decide after you actually realize why you're making comic books in the first place, the second thing you have to figure out is what story are you telling and why are you telling that particular story? And that it actually, there's three basic types of stories when it comes to comics. There's an original story, which is an idea that you make up on your own or in, you know, conjunction with other people. There is what's called public domain works, where you're actually using something that someone else created, but the copyright has expired. So now anyone can use that idea. Things like Sherlock Holmes or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or The Odyssey, things that no one actually owns the rights to, you can make a comic book out of that. Or you can go the what's called with a license work, where it is intellectual property that someone else owns, but you're going to get the ability to make that comic. So something like when IDW or Boom makes Transformers or Aliens or Powerpuff Girls or whatever, it's a something that exists in another medium, but you get the right to use it. So when I say you have to get a story that you own or control, you either have to make up the story or you have to get the rights to the story one way or another. Because if you fail to do that, you're actually infringing on someone else's intellectual property. And that could lead to you, A, wasting a lot of time and money making something that you're not going to benefit from, and B, being faced with several different levels of legal action against you because you made a book that you didn't have the right to make.
Those are very important areas, and I have a question about one of them that I haven't encountered this specific scenario before. All of the stories that I've heard about people working on licensed properties are, you know, it's the standard escalating improvement in the your level of stature in the business or whatever. Mm-hmm. Once you reach a certain level, there are some publishers that might reach out to you and say, "Hey, we've got this licensed property. We think you might have an interesting contribution to it. Why don't you give us a pitch?" What I've never heard of, and maybe this is just so rare it never happens, let's say a comic creator has an idea for a licensed property that is actually dormant, that is something that a major media conglomerate has sitting dusty in their archives, and they don't realize that it could be rebooted in some sort of interesting way for a contemporary audience. Now, the creator, there seems to be like a catch-22 in that scenario, because if you approach the copyright holder, you're kind of going to have to divulge your spin and your take on the reboot to begin with, and you kind of are losing your right to it just by doing that. How does one navigate that sort of scenario?
Well, I actually have some clients who have done that in the past, where they find a property that's you know, it's, there's still a copyright holder, but it's an older property that isn't being used. And usually the copyright holder is not interested in going through the process of producing and publishing a comic. So even if you tell them your idea and they might have the right to do it, that doesn't mean they're going to do it, because they may not want to make comics. They have no incentive to do that. So in most cases, you're really not going to, you're better off trying that route, or trying to actually, you know, create a scenario where you can get the license without losing your ability to like be the one to take the comic to market. But in the cases that I've seen, in that particular scenario, the license holder doesn't want to make comics. They might want a film later, and they might think because of things that are happening in, you know, the streaming wars and, you know, in the theaters before COVID, that if they give you the right to make a comic, then someone else might be interested in making the film. So that could be a way you can pitch it to them. It's like, well, you let me make the comic, and then together we'll make the movie. But in a lot of cases, you don't even have to go that far, because the people who holding the rights never thought about making a comic, and they don't know how to make a comic. So you're usually fine. But it's on a case-by-case basis.
Sure, sure. So one of the other areas that is covered in the book is one that I've found to be, you could write a whole book on this topic in and of itself, in my opinion, and that's finding and hiring a professional team to create your book and support your business. I'm a writer, and the process of finding collaborators is a spooky art, and there are a number of hills and valleys in that. Could you speak a little bit to your recommendations for people, I guess, on both sides of the creative divide there?
Okay, well, the key that I think to finding a creative team, because there's a lot of different methods you can use offline and online. There's a lot of different approaches you can take, active or passive searching. But the key to all of them is getting a very good understanding of what the potential team member can and cannot do. And the best way that I think to do that is a very concise, very short-term test. It's kind of like the analogy that I think I used in the book was, if you think your person can actually be in the X-Men, don't send them out to fight Magneto first. Put them in the danger room first. And if they can't actually get through the danger room, well, okay, then maybe they shouldn't go out fight Juggernaut, should they? They should just, then you know, you haven't spent a lot of money on that person. You haven't spent a lot of time on that person. You basically have them, if they're an artist, have them do like 2 pages. You pay them for the 2 pages. And if you like the way that they produce the work, you like the interaction between the two of you, then sign them on to do, maybe they'll do 10 pages. Maybe they'll do the cover. And if it doesn't work out, well, at least you now have 2 pages that you can use, you know, for extras for the Kickstarter, or 2 pages that you could use for something else. It's not a waste, but it's better than, you know, the first artist that you interact with suddenly giving them the contract for your entire 22-page book before you can find out whether you can work with them or not.
Yeah. I have one question about that. I learned the hard way to get to that approach on the small test front. There's still one kind of danger area that I've encountered, and it's kind of in a more medium scope risk category, and that's there are some collaborators who can pass that first threshold test, and then you commit to a longer scope project, let's say like a one shot that's 20 pages, and then you find out for whatever reason the scale of the project, they're just not up for it, either on the timeline basis or whatever. And you get halfway into that, you've got 10 pages. At that point, you can't really use the 10 pages because, I mean, you can use them for extras or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you're really going to complete this book, most people are not going to want to see the artist shift halfway through.
Right.
And so I've been trying to figure out ways to incentivize and structure contracts in ways that put an emphasis on full completion as opposed to partial completion.
Right.
How can someone go about doing that?
Well, what I usually recommend in those cases is something called structuring the deliverables and the payment in a manner that I refer to as the tennis method. So let's say you sign on an artist to do 20 pages. They, at the signing of the contract, they might get 20% of the total compensation. And then after every 5 pages, they get more of the fee, so that there's never a time when they don't have the full fee until they've actually produced the full pages, and you don't have to lose that money until you actually get what it is that you want. There's a little bit of risk to you at the beginning, and there's a little bit of risk for you at the end, but because the pages and the payments are traveling back and forth in an alternative kind of manner, you're protecting yourself more than if you, because it's difficult for you to pay all the money up front to get the pages, because then you have no leverage to get the finished product. And it's very difficult to convince any freelance artist to produce all the work up front before they see any of the money, because then they have no incentive to actually do the work, especially if they have 3 or 4 other projects that are going on. So if you go with a back and forth kind of structure between deliverables and compensation, you can mitigate some of that risk. There will always be a risk, but you could reduce it that way.
Yeah. And maybe I should have back up here and ask you this question. How much of a barrier do you think it is for creative people to adopt the businessman mindset, to adopt that entrepreneurial mindset? Because just speaking for myself, you know, I'm driven by the love of the craft and the desire to get the work out there. And yeah, some money would be fantastic. Yeah, throw me the money, please. Yeah, hooray. But absent that, there's kind of a familial, you know, creative community feeling of like, hey, we're all quirky creative types, and we're trying to do our thing here. But there are some sharks out there who will take advantage of naivety. And I definitely got bit a number of times. How do you coach people into adopting this? Because comics is supposed to be fun. Creating is supposed to be fun. Mm-hmm, business doesn't sound fun. How do you talk us into, you know, protecting ourselves and doing the right thing?
Well, it is the easiest way to explain it is that it is more fun to actually do the work that you enjoy doing and like not worry about losing money, losing rights, losing time. It's more fun. You have more fun making comics that way when you know that you actually are getting a benefit from it in addition to making the book than it is to make comics that you love but not really know what's going to happen or how it's going to happen, or getting burned and losing your rights or losing money or having a contract go sideways or doing work and then there is no contract so you don't get what you were promised. Those are the things that make the comic book industry less fun. I think that you're going to have several different sets of people, especially reading this book. There's going to be the people who read the book and then decide, well, they don't really want to do the business side of it. They want to do the creative side of it. And for those people, which is a perfectly valid way to approach it, I think they should actually focus more on freelance comic book creation, where they don't have to worry about whether or not the book gets out the door. They don't have to worry about whether or not the book makes money. All they have to do is worry about finding work, finishing their work, and getting a fee for their work. And then they can move on. There's another set of people that are more of the in the creator-driven type of space, where they are very comfortable in putting a team together and developing an idea and making a plot and even getting to the point where there's finished pages, but they don't necessarily want to handle the advertising, the distribution issues. They don't want to handle the sales funnel. They don't want to handle the revenue and all that. They just want to put the book together and then they'll hand the book to like an Image or an Aftershock or somebody, let them handle that piece, and they'll just go back to make books, which is also another perfectly reasonable way to go about it. But if you can get the most out of comics if you actually embrace the creative side and the business side, because if you have both sides, then you can actually go much further and you actually have more of an understanding of what's going on, even when you're doing the creative aspect of your book, because there are several chapters in the book that actually talk about what kind of comic are you going to make and why are you going to make a specific type of comic, whether that's a webcomic or a single issue or a limited series or a graphic novel. There's business concepts that actually play into each one of those choices. And if you understand the business concepts, then it's easier to wrap your head around, well, I'm looking at my story. What is this story actually going to be when it's in a physical, well, when it's finished? The idea of how long do you want your story to last? Do you want it to be like, an extreme example is like The Far Side. Every comic, quote unquote, is one panel. He never goes back to that story. There's no continuation. It's just one panel. And then on the other side, you have somebody like Todd McFarlane, who's literally just got a Guinness Book of World Records award because Spawn has lasted for so many issues. There's a huge gap between the business models for those two creators, but that's still comics. Everybody can actually understand what they want to do and how to do it and enjoy it more if they get at least a foundation in understanding the business concepts.
That is absolutely true. You mentioned in the course of that, the distribution process and advertising specifically. I wanted to ask you about that. Do you have any advice on advertising channels, the utility of it? The indie comics game right now seems very social media driven, it seems hard to, if you did have some resources to put towards advertising, let me just tell you a story that I personally am going through. I have a book coming out soon and, I don't have the slightest clue what the rates to purchase advertising are on some of the well-known comic sites. And just to inquire, I reached out to one of the most prominent ones and they never even got back to me. It's like, they don't even want my money or what? I don't know. So I don't know if the system's broken or what the deal is.
Well, when you're talking about advertising, especially for independent comics, you have to look at, in my opinion, you have to look at advertising as an extension of your marketing. And your marketing kind of needs to start, well, definitely needs to start before the book is finished. You have to go through the research process of understanding who it is that is most likely to read your book and where those people actually congregate and what other books they may or may not be reading and how many potential people are there out there who might like the story that's in your book, but then they don't read comics. Because once you actually wrap your head around those marketing concepts, you can start to develop relationships with groups of people who are much more inclined to read your comic. The problem with going to like mainstream comic book sites is that they are trying to generate advertising revenue from very large players. So, and they're trying to hit very broad audiences. Even if they did get back to you with a CPM rate and they gave you their, you know, media kit to tell you how much it would cost, they would probably not be delivering to you, even if you could pay them, because the prices might be extremely high. Even if you could pay them, they wouldn't be delivering the type of readers that you want, because every comic, because it has a specific story and a specific appeal, is going to appeal to a specific group of people who may or may not actually be visiting that site and may or may not even be reading comics. So if you know who is the ideal reader for your book and you can figure out where those people are, you can do it in such a way so that when you start advertising, you're spending very little money. You're spending actually more time and investment in interacting with the people who are more likely to read your book, so that you can avoid having to drop significant amounts of money on advertising fees and focus more of your money on whether that's paying for sponsorships or paying for media coverage in terms of actual articles, or paying for something else that's going to benefit your book more than just paying for ads that might not actually benefit you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you have a strong feel either way on the role that tabling at conventions plays? I know that not all of us necessarily have the capability of committing a significant amount of time to go to shows. And of course, right now we're in a pandemic, and so there aren't even any shows happening. But knock on wood, once we reach a post-pandemic world, what is your opinion of the utility of that approach and how to balance it with other ways to reach out to audiences?
Well, one of the things that I go into in the chapters on conventions is the pros and cons of tabling, because depending on who you're working with, where the convention is, how much the convention's going to cost, how many, like, if let's say you have a book out, how many copies of that book do you have to sell at the convention to A, cover the cost of going to the convention, and B, making a profit? Once you actually know, the short answer is you have to break down every convention on a case-by-case basis. And I provide in the book a form that you can actually fill out. Well, how much is it going to cost to go to one convention versus another convention? Because once you actually have that number in terms of a hard financial answer, then you can go, okay, the convention that's in the next town over, that make more sense to do, just because from a financial aspect, than it would for me to go to New York in October and get a table there, just because I would have to spend so much more money to break even. Well, so much more money to get there. I'd have to sell so many more copies to break even. And there's going to be so many more people there that it may not make sense. So there is an evaluation process for tabling at conventions that I go through in the book. And there's also a process that I lay out for going to a convention and specifically not tabling, because there's a lot of different functions that a convention can provide for a creator. And if you happen to be the only one at your table and you're stuck behind the booth for 12 hours, you're stuck at the table for 12 hours, you may not be able to take advantage of a lot of the things that going to a convention has to offer. So in your analysis of every convention, there's should I go or should I not go? And then there's should I get a table or should I not get a table? And there's different permutations of those answers based on the cost, based on what else is going on, and based on what you could actually do at the table. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. And just anecdotally, I've seen that both in myself and some peers in the game, that some shows you go to and you look forward to and you had hoped to have a table, but then for whatever reason you couldn't table, and it turned out that show was actually an even better show for you because of the amount of networking you got to do and the outreach you got to do with fellow creators and potential audiences. And then there are other shows where, you know, tabling, it turned out to be completely the right choice. Well, so I think that's an important distinction to go through for sure.
Yeah, it just sounds like you guys experienced the benefits of tabling versus not tabling from an organic standpoint. This show turned out to be good. That show turned out to be better for the other thing. The only difference that I would describe is that you're actually laying that all those variables out before you fill out the form for the table. And that way you actually have a much better idea of which shows you're going to apply which tactic to, and then every show could be better overall.
Yeah. So one thing that you mentioned as a section in the book is creating comics that you can be proud of on time and under budget. And I would have to classify a project that meets both those criteria as maybe being a miracle. So I would like to see that in my lifetime. Give me some pointers on how to hit both of those goals.
Well, when you're talking about on time and under budget are two different processes that are actually related. You're talking about on time, that is a function of your production schedule. So when you decide, okay, I want to make this comic, one of the things you have to decide when you get to the production process is, when is this book supposed to come out? And is it a book that is it time sensitive or is it not time sensitive? Because like, let's say you're doing a horror book, because that's one of the easiest examples. A horror books, anecdotally, do better around Halloween. So if you decide in the summer that you're going to do a horror book, you should not actually plan to have your horror book on the shelf that Halloween. You're now talking about probably a Halloween a year from now, just when you understand all the steps that are involved in getting that in motion. But there are other books that don't really have any kind of time-sensitive nature. So you can do what a lot of this is very prevalent in the video game industry, where a game will not come out until it's ready to come out. And those are usually the stronger games because everything is fixed before it actually ships, as opposed to a game that is, well, we have this date and now the game has to come out, whether it's ready or not, whether it works or not. And those are the ones that often stumble because you're forcing a process that you didn't give proper time. When you're talking about under budget, the idea is you have a profit and loss statement. You know exactly from every standpoint how much everything costs. And you know, because you have a pre-existing investment of how much money you're willing to spend on this book, the cost of the book has to be under what the budget is for the book. Otherwise, the book is over budget and already running at a loss. And that's not really a good way to actually have books come out. Once you actually lay out what the budget is, if you see that, okay, the cost per page, when you're actually counting your creative, the cost per page is too high based on what the budget is. So you now have to figure out either A, can you increase the budget, or B, can you actually reduce the per page cost? And if you massage that and you allow for a certain amount of unexpected overhead, your project can come in on time and under budget. You have to have a lot of good decisions and planning has to be done in the pre-production stage, but it can happen. It actually happens all the time in comics, on time, under budget.
All right. I hope I live to see it personally. I believe it does exist. You've convinced me.
Yes. It's not a unicorn. Trust me. You can do it. It could happen. It can happen.
So, and as we're talking about, you know, happy outcomes, one of the things you talk about in the book is using comics to generate multiple streams of revenue. And I'm curious as to some of the ideas and suggestions you have along those lines.
Okay, well, because comics are essentially content, and content draws interest from the right people. Once you actually draw in interest, there are several ways you can leverage that into streams of revenue, depending on the project and your relationship to your readers. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is indirect sources of revenue. So you might have on your website, when you put up the pages, you might have advertising on the website that actually brings in revenue on a cost per thousand basis. You might decide to do affiliate marketing with products that are directly related to the subject matter in your book, where then you get a cut of the products that are sold if those sales are driven through your website, because you're attracting those types of people with your content. There are also potential opportunities for sponsorships for your comic, where there is a monetary benefit that comes from a third party that wants to get their name or their brand in front of your readers. And then you have, you know, more standard models like the crowdfunding model that has actually come up over the past 5 or 10 years to be a major source of revenue for independent creators. And then you get to the sales aspect, where you're actually selling, you're trading your book for revenue. And when you do that, you can actually generate revenue through digital sales, through various different types of business models. You can generate print sales in the direct market, or in the bookstore channel, or in the library channel, or in the convention channel. So if you have one book, depending on how you want to position it and how you want to generate revenue, there are at least a half dozen ways that you can explore to actually go about doing that.
Along those lines, one question that I have just started to entertain is when a project is most appropriate for seeking publishers and when it's most appropriate for self-publishing. Mm-hmm. And when I first thought about doing comics about a decade ago, I just sort of naively assumed that the desired goal for every project would be to find a publisher. Mm-hmm. And I have discovered over the course of time that that's not necessarily always going to be the case. Do you agree that there are certain projects that fit a certain framework more suited for each?
Yes. But, well, one of the first things you have to kind of wrap your head around is, where do you actually want to go in your career in comics? Because there are certain people who have had a huge amount of success in comics with a creator-driven model. There are people who have had success with the independent publishing model. And then there's people who've had huge success in the freelance model. So where you actually want to go and how you see yourself is the first step to actually figuring out what it is that you want to do. The second thing is to take a look at the story that you have and take a look at the publishers who are out there, because you can find a list of all the major publishers and you can see what's in their catalog and look at the story that you have. If your goal is to get it with a publisher, then you probably want to approach a publisher who has been publishing books similar to the idea that you're working on. You don't want to approach someone with something like, if someone's publishing a lot of like historical romance comics and you've got like a slasher horror comic, well, they probably don't want your comic, because that's not the market that they've built up. That's not the business that they're in. So you have to kind of pick and choose your story and your goals when you go to find a publisher. The beautiful thing about independent publishing is you can decide, well, I don't necessarily want, for whatever reason, to go through a traditional publisher with this particular story, maybe because you want complete creative control. Maybe it's because you don't actually think it really fits anywhere. Maybe it's because you think that this story is something that's going to go farther if you actually are able to control everything yourself. It might just be, because if it's your first comic, this is not your situation, but if it's your first comic, you might want this to be your proof of concept. You want to be able to walk into a room and say, I can prove that I can make comics because I made a comic. And I understand the process because I've done this entire thing myself. And that's a benefit to making your own comic that goes above and beyond the actual comic that's in front of you. So once you actually understand those variables, you get a better idea of when a particular project should go to a major publisher when it should go to a traditional publisher that has a graphic novel imprint, whether you should self-publish it, whether you should do something else. It's dependent a lot on who you are and the story you're telling.
So let's go a little bit deeper on one of those scenarios. Let's say that you have concluded that for the particular project, self-publishing would maybe make the most sense. I don't personally have a lot of experience or knowledge in either one of these channels, but correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that the barrier to entry to getting something self-published in Diamond is significantly easier than a distributor who like would distribute to more traditional bookstores like Barnes & Noble.
Well, the thing about Diamond is, and a lot of the other publishers that have come up in the past 12 to 18 months, is that they have divisions that distribute books to bookstores. So if you go through Diamond, Diamond has a bookstore channel. So it's not as if you go with Diamond, you have to go find some other way to get your book into bookstores. But the other thing you need to understand is there's distributors for books that are growing in their ability to actually place comics. So the problem is not that the bookstores can't buy comics. It is that the publishers and the self-publishers, independent publishers, don't do the work to actually convince the bookstores to buy the comic. Because just because Diamond offers a book, and this goes for bookstores and, you know, comic book shops, just because a book is available in Diamond doesn't mean a store is going to order it. They have to make the decision to order it, and that decision has to be based on their belief that the book is going to sell. So if you as a publisher can convince the bookstore that, yeah, I have a following, this book has legs, and you once you buy it, it's going to go out the door, then they're more likely to buy it. The barrier to entry is that a lot of people, I believe, are only doing one step. They make sure that their book gets into the Diamond catalog, but they don't make sure that their ultimate customers, especially in the comic book market, which are the comic book shop owners, they don't convince the comic book shop owners to buy it. So you have a product available for sale that no one has actually decided to buy. Therein lies the problem.
So one other area that I'm currently trying to wrestle with is, you know, comics itself is, and it, maybe it always seems this way, but it seems like it's in a very transitional period right now. And in addition to the distribution crises relating to the pandemic, the split up of DC away from Diamond, the rise of some other alternative distribution models, you've also got this growing audience that is reading sequential art, but they're not reading it from your standard local comic book shop. Uh-huh. They're getting books online. They're reading things like webtoons. And I feel like I'm like Clint Eastwood saying, get off my lawn when it comes to webtoon, because when I go look at webtoon and I see the numbers that some of these books are getting, I'm just overwhelmed by the size of the success, and also comparing the level of writing and art that's available in some of those webtoons that have like 500,000 views to the caliber of work being put out in your standard, you know, Boom, Image, Vault, Scout, SourcePoint books. I see this huge mismatch. And so I'm tempted to try to learn what's going on in the webtoon space. What am I missing? What am I not understanding? Should I get with that revolution, even though it feels out of place for me?
Well, you've actually raised several different questions in that one statement. What you have to kind of wrap your head around is that every book has its own audience. And if you can find that audience, whether or not objectively or subjectively, there are certain criteria for like quality in terms of art or writing. If the book finds its audience, then the book will do well. One only has to look at things like Fifty Shades of Grey or Sharknado or, I don't know, Keeping Up with the Kardashians. From any objective standpoint, these are not the finest pieces of content that the artistic community has ever produced, but they are successful. They're successful because they, A, know what they are, B, they actually play to the audience that that is for, and then they lean into that. Now, webtoons, there's a, those artists have a lot of things going for them in terms of how they go about reaching their audience, how they go about interacting with their audience, the frequency of which they're posting. They're, they have very specific systems that work, A, for their content, and B, for their audience. So if you decide, and there's a certain amount of, there's a lower barrier to entry for those books for certain audiences, if you actually look at it from a demographic standpoint, because they, I believe on a certain level, the type of person that's reading webtoons and is basically at this point grown up to a certain extent on webtoons is not necessarily the same person that historically frequented the comic book shop. And because there are just literally more people who are, and there's that number is growing all the time, who are discovering comics online as opposed to discovering comics the way you and I probably discovered comics in print, either on a newsstand or in a comic shop, those numbers are going to be different because the scale and scope of those markets are going to be different. So yes, there is a lot of things that you can learn from the webtoons creators, as long as you're willing to embrace that there are new distribution methods, and those distribution methods require certain changes in the way that you do business. Because if you're going to stay in the market where, okay, I want to distribute to direct market shops, well, by definition, you have just said you want to actually distribute to about 2,000 retail outlets scattered across the country, which means a lot of people, even if they wanted to read a comic book like yours, can't get it because they don't, A, don't know where the comic book shop is, B, they can't get to the comic book shop, and C, even if they did go to the comic book shop, they're probably going to the comic book shop for a book they already have an emotional investment in. Mm-hmm. There's a very, very small group of people, in my estimation, that are going to comic book shops on a regular basis to buy whatever they happen to see. If they're going to comic book shops on a regular basis, it's probably because there is a book or a series of books that they already know that they like. And they will get those books, and they'll probably have, you know, cover blindness to everything else that's in the store. So if you have a new book or a new story and you don't actually build up an audience first, even if your book gets into Diamond, even if your book gets on the shelf of the comic book shop, that doesn't necessarily mean anyone's going to buy it, because that's not the way comic book shop buying happens. Think about you yourself when you go to a comic book shop. Do you just browse and then pick up anything that happens to look kind of good? And if you did, I would say that's because you're a comic book creator, not necessarily a pure comic book reader. But even then, a lot of people have very specific tastes of what they do and don't like. And if your book doesn't actually hook them instantly, you're not going to make that sale if you don't build up the audience beforehand.
That sounds like an interesting concept. Describe that to me a little bit more. How do you build an audience for something beforehand?
Okay, well, you actually are familiar. You're already familiar with it, even if you don't realize it. Think about this. When Avengers Endgame first got announced, they started, you know, the cast started doing interviews. They started putting out like teaser trailers and behind the scenes stuff. That is marketing for a film. The film didn't actually do principal production. They didn't do the after effects. They only had a date and a script and a cast. But so the product, the content was not made. But the marketing, the building up of that audience happened long before the actual release date of the movie, because on a certain level, the marketing for that movie had been going on since 2009, because every movie then becomes marketing for the next movie. And in between movies, they're constantly doing things to keep those audiences engaged, even though those audiences are A, millions and millions of people, and B, they don't really need, so at a certain level, it was a self-running machine. Endgame didn't necessarily need five teaser trailers, because right. A, it was the sequel to one of the biggest movies of all time, and B, it was the end of a, 21 movie saga. So it's like, everybody knows what's going on, just release the thing and we'll buy the tickets. But that's not the way they did it. They built up that anticipation and that excitement for about a year before the movie came out. If you're doing comics, you kind of have to do the same thing. Find the people that'll be most interested in your book, start engaging with them about the things that they like, slowly introduce the concepts that you're going to be working with in your book, and then the artwork, and then kind of give people incentives to kind of get involved with what you're doing, so that by the time the book is actually ready to come out, there's a couple thousand people that have been primed and are waiting and are ready and anxious for that book. So the book comes out and the pre-sale, or the first day numbers or the pre-orders cover the cost of the book.
It's funny to me, what you have just explained is simultaneously common sense and also, but also revelatory to me. And let me explain why. I think I overlearned a wrong lesson of something that happened about like 7 or 8 years ago. I'm sure you probably remember this, but in the tens, Image started doing their own convention event. And sometimes it would be right the week before San Diego or something. And they did about like 5 or 6 of these in about a 4-year period. Mm-hmm. And they ended up announcing a very large number of books that eventually never even came to exist. Right. And so there was a certain amount of jadedness to that pre-marketing approach, mm-hmm. because of all of those failures. And I think I should have just ignored those bad lessons and stuck with the wisdom of what you've described about, fertilizing the ground as early as possible.
Well, there's always the risk. Even when you're doing like a Kickstarter, there's the thing at the bottom, the risk that this project will never actually come out or whatever. But if you're actually controlling your budgets and your time, there's no reason why you shouldn't be announcing that you should be announcing a project that's not going to come out. But even in that scenario, I would argue if you've built up an audience around the type of work that you're doing or the type of story that you're telling, and a particular project stalls for whatever reason, you can, because you have an engaged community that you're actively talking to, you can actually explain that to them and pivot into whatever the next project happens to be. Because when you're actually doing this kind of engagement, you're not asking people to pre-order anything until the book is actually made. So now it's just people who know you and like the things that you're talking about, and they know that you're working on something and they're excited for you. But if the book stalls for whatever reason, they didn't spend any money on it. So you have more to gain by building that audience beforehand than you have to lose by not announcing anything until the book comes out, and then hoping to find an audience after the book is released when the cat's already out the door.
Or yeah. Out
the bag, yeah. Or whatever the analogy is.
Right, right. I've taken a lot of your time here, but I want to hit you with one other topic. I think I'd be remiss to not go over the concept of multimedia deals and adaptations, because not a day and sometimes not an hour goes by on comics social media that you don't hear about some sort of option, mm-hmm. From a comics project. And I've found that negotiating the multimedia aspects of a hypothetical project is becoming more and more a part of just getting a book published. And my attitude to this aspect of comic creation was, hey, that's all fanciful, hypothetical, funny money. I'm not really all that focused on that. Sure, I would love it if something I created got adapted. But at the moment, I'm just focusing on, you know, making a name and trying to get books produced, even with the full knowledge of all the cautionary tales of comic creators who kind of royally messed themselves over by being negligent in thinking about those things. But my thinking on this has shifted a lot. And I was wondering if you could first give some broad advice about people going into a publishing deal, what they should be thinking about, what they should be looking for, what they should reasonably expect to be able to negotiate, and what should they reasonably expect, like, hey, this is de facto standard. You're just going to have to deal with it if you're dealing with a publisher.
Mm-hmm. Well, what should, it all goes back to what it is that your goals are and how much you actually understand of the business process. If you go to a publisher and you say you want them to publish your book because it's a creator-driven book, it's actually incumbent upon you to look at the landscape and try to figure out, okay, through your research, which publishers get the publishing rights to your book and then publish the book, and then they share the actual, you know, the royalties with you of how much the book makes, and then leave you to have the media rights for yourself, because that's not the business that they're in. There's quite a few publishers that they say, okay, you and we're going to like do a deal for the publishing rights. We're not going to try to do a deal for the media rights because that's not our business. There are other publishers that want to take in the comic book purely because they hope that that's going to spin off into another deal, a bigger deal for like games or TV or movies or whatever. That's fine too, as long as you understand the terms of the deal and you know what you will and will not get when you actually sign that deal. If you can't understand and your lawyer cannot explain to you how you would get paid if the thing became a movie, then it is very likely you won't be paid. So you have to ask yourself, well, do I want to sign a deal where the book comes out and the movie gets made and I make zero? Most people would say, no, I don't actually want that deal. So then you know that you should probably not take that particular deal. Then there's the other types of deals, which are the worst type of deal, where you go in to get a book published, and the deal that they put on the table is you're basically signing over ownership and control of the entire intellectual property to the publisher in exchange for basically nothing. And those deals, once your lawyer explains it to you, that you're going to give away everything that you've worked on, you're not going to get paid for it, and there's no way you're ever going to get those rights back, then you know that you shouldn't take that deal. So it all depends on what it is that you want, what it is that every publisher is offering, because a lot different publishers are offering different things in their deals. So as long as you understand what the deal is and understand what you want, you can understand which deals to accept and which deals to reject.
I'm terribly naive when it comes to this aspect of the business. Do you have any feel for, is there any middle ground in there? Because the contracts I've seen some of my peers have talked about, they seem pretty heavily in one direction or the other. Are there any that seem to be kind of in more of a partnership league where both sides in the arrangement have certain powers, like things are not totally exclusively owned by the creator or not exclusively by the publisher, to where both sides are free to market a thing for some sort of adaptation and mutually benefit? Does that ever happen, or is it usually just one or the other?
No, I think there's, at this stage, and this is something that's changing, there's pretty much an even split in the deals that I see my clients bring to me, where some of them are very straightforward. It's like, the publisher doesn't have any media rights. You're fine. Go do whatever it is you're going to do. And there's like, that's like a third of them. And then there's a third of them is like, well, if we're going to publish your book, we'll also try to shop your media deal. And if we actually land a deal, this is what you get, this is what we get, and everybody will be happy because we got a media deal. That's about a third. And then there's about a third of them that's basically, you sign this and we will own it and you will not, and you should not have signed that in the first place. But that's about a third. So it actually evens out across the board at this point. But I think because the trend is now shifting more towards, we just published a book, you deal with the media rights, you're going to get more of an even split in that direction. That is my hope.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, Gamal, thank you so much for spending this time with me. We've been on for almost an hour here and it has just flown by. I appreciate all of the wisdom and advice you've given us. Where can people find the ability to get the book?
Well, they can go to Kickstarter. We have about 12 days left on the Kickstarter. You can either type in The Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing or my name, Gamal Hennessy, and it will pop up. We have print versions, digital versions, and we have combination packages of print and digital. There's also a tier of perks that if you get the digital version, you can also get an hour-long consultation with me. So I would actually basically go through with someone the entire process of independent comic book publishing for their particular book so that they can get a more of an insight on how they should approach their particular publishing goals.
That is great. That is great. And where can we find you on social media?
Oh, you can find me most of the time on Facebook or Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn, but not very much. All you have to do is type in my name. There's not going to be many Gamal Hennessys that are going to pop up besides me.
Great, great. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on, and thanks for everything. And I look forward to read the book.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.